I'm Christian Scheller. Welcome to my podcast, an enthusiastic ramble through whatever has taken my interest the past week or so. Expect technology, games, history, travel, geekery, and as always, much, much more. This is Chris Chinchilla with another Chinchilla Squeaks. This is an interview show. I have an interesting interview for you, very much fitting into the zeitgeist. I was about to say the zeitgeist of the times, but that's kind of unnecessary. One and the same thing. I tried to have a news show last week, but we were traveling, and normally I wouldn't use that as an excuse. I have given you plenty of news shows whilst traveling, but we were traveling to Australia, which I think is a better excuse because the days either side of it really just eat up all your time, not only the journey itself, and I don't know, it just never happened. So I thought we'll just jump straight to the interview this week instead. So who is my subject? It is Data Sebo. Now, I must admit, when I first read the website, they described themselves as synthetic data for enterprise. And I kind of thought, sort of vaguely interesting, you know, a service for generative AI data for testing all sorts of things, basically testing hypotheses and this kind of thing. But I sort of thought, you know, we've sort of had things like this before with fake data and things like that. But then after actually speaking, I found everything far more interesting. They have an enterprise tool. They have some open source tools as well. And yeah, I ended up finding this conversation quite interesting, and I hope you do too. But before we jump into that, here are a few words from sponsors. Today I'm joined by Kalyan from Data Sebo. And now, you are one of a handful of companies I spoke to over the past few months providing synthetic data through generative AI. Mm-hmm. Let's firstly maybe begin with the kind of data you're providing, and then maybe we will fire that, get into the use case.
Great. The kind of data that we work with is something that I call the third kind of data. So language is the first and image is the second. Yeah. This third kind of data is a lot of enterprise data that is stored in tables or log files, or a lot of data that enterprises collect in their day-to-day business activities or when the consumers or customers use their product and services. Okay. Yeah. So that's the kind of the data that we focus on.
Yeah. So I think anyone listening could probably already start to just think of what some of the use cases could be, but maybe before we get to that, what prompted you to get started with the company in the first place? What was the journey to get there?
good question. So I run an applied machine learning lab at MIT. I've been working on applied machine learning for almost a decade now. So as part of the lab, we help enterprises build machine learning models to make predictions. Mm-hmm. So a lot of enterprises come to us. I work for BBVA, the bank, Jaguar and Land Rover, the car company, Accenture, a satellite company, a ton of companies. And in most of the cases, we would get the data from them that we would like to use to build the models. But the data has to be stored in a very secure place and be, you know, we can't upload it to cloud, no matter what the volume is. It has to be in a very secure place, and that's how we would give access to the students. And one of the challenges that we were facing again and again, that, you know, we would put it on one machine, and in one extreme case, that machine was actually disconnected. It was to be disconnected from the internet. So we were actually cycling the students on that machine. Like, we would have a timeshare of that machine to work with the data. And I wasn't like, you know, this is 20, you know, last decade, right? 2010s. And this is MIT. We are talking about this. And this was what was happening in terms of data access. So it really hurt the productivity of the students. So we thought one day, what if we just mocked up some data? So we look at the format, look at the column types, and look at the data types. And what if we mock up the data? And that was, we wrote a script to mock it up, and we tried to give that mock-up data to students so at least they can make some progress, they can develop the software. And that did not work. The mock-up was not, it is what we now call fake data. That did not really work because it didn't actually capture all the properties of the data. And so then we said, hey, generative modeling is supposed to be able to capture the properties of data in a concise manner, and then we should be able to sample a database out of it. So why don't we create a generative model? And then we created a generative model, first generative model for relational databases. That turned out to be successful for that project. And then that itself spun out into a whole new project, saying that how generalizable is this, and resulted in this project called Synthetic Data Vault.
Yep, I can see that. Yeah, I've come across that on GitHub. Yeah.
Yes, and then we sort of open sourced it. We built a few more models, and then we started to realize that this is a much bigger problem across the board. Data access, by which we mean getting access to the right data at the right time to get your work done and get move and have productivity, is a bigger challenge. So as a result, we started building a product, and we launched the company. We started the company in 2020 and launched SDV Enterprise version of it in last December.
So I would imagine, I think a lot of people who have, actually, no, I'm going to ask a different question. So when we talk about the synthetic data, what is the intended use? Like in my head, I immediately jump to thinking of things like testing. Mm-hmm. You know, often you just use this kind of throwaway nonsense test data, which doesn't really prove anything because it's usually just rubbish. Are you providing for those kind of use cases, or is it for more for learning purposes, for modeling, or all of the above?
All of the above. I think the biggest use case that we've honed in first is still testing. I'm so glad that you mentioned that. It is one of the use cases that is so underserved, but there is so much need for it, especially because enterprises have gone from monolithic to smaller applications. So there are several hundreds, or some companies have thousands of applications. And the second thing is, most of these applications now are data-driven. What I mean by that is there is a lot of conditional logic based on the data. So the data they see, if you see this, go this path. If you see this, go this path. I mean, historically, that was done for online retailers like Amazon trying to optimize their browsing, sort of like people's browsing experience. But now it's there in every piece of software we write. It's all data-driven. And to test that, I think people are still using the classical old techniques of writing manual rules, or worst even, generate just fake data, just random fake data, which doesn't work because it doesn't, like, you can imagine the conditions are dependent on correlation. So you see this value for this variable and this value for this variable, then take this path. In fake data, what if you don't have those combinations at all? So I think the largest and most powerful use case is synthetic data for application testing. Okay. And what is also very, in that particular scenario, what is also less known is how dramatically changes the game, having a generative model and generating synthetic data from that. So what do I mean by that is that once you build a generative model, you can sample as much as you want. So if you built it on 10,000 customers' data, you can sample 10 million customers' data, or even 1 billion customers' data. That is not possible with even classical techniques of giving data access, which is like copy, mask, or anonymize. That's not possible because you can't just expand the data. You can just subset it. At most, you can subset it and or maybe give the full data that you have. So this is a very powerful property of this technology, powerful functionality of this technology. And what that enables is, right off the bat, it is a powerful, it gives people to be able to do performance testing right off the bat. On day one, they can start doing performance testing with volumes of data that looks as real and is statistically correlated.
Yeah, I definitely have come across these kind of mock data services. I think, let's take a kind of classic example that developers make so many assumptions with, like address data. Something that has a very good real world correlation, and there are definitely data sets that people could pull from, addresses. Mm-hmm. So a good non-generative fake data providing service, shall we say, versus Datasebo. Now what are you offering on top of just a service that can generate just a lot of good, meaningful test data at scale? Is it that flexibility when it isn't as clear cut as something like a dress is? Mm-hmm. Is it that, you know, that, like I think you said, the it doesn't really matter if it's 10 or 10 million records. Mm-hmm. The model could kind of keep going. Yeah. Well, what do you add on top of those?
Yeah.
I don't think there's many, but those traditional kind of data fake services.
Yes. So there's a very popular library called Faker, from which what you mentioned, you can create fake addresses. What we do is we invented something called contextual anonymization. Contextual generation. So what that means is when we look at the address, we have a generator that strips the address into context. So it extracts out a number of variables that are contextual. So it will extract that this address is from New York, it's in USA, obviously. And then also it will even figure out the block in which New York, which borough, like it will extract a variety of context variables. And then it will model those context variables together with the other variables in the data. So it will actually model, you know, if it's, let's say, transactions, and it turns out that New Yorkers buy more on Friday night, it will just model the correlation between those context variables, because we now know the context of the address with the other variables as well. So when you sample from this generative model, behind the scenes, this is all happening behind the scenes. The user doesn't see it.
Yeah.
You sample first the context, and then you recreate the address that is not the original address. So it's still a pseudo or a fake address, but has the same context as the original address. It's from New York and so on and so forth. So the advantage there is, like, if your original data had like 40% addresses from New York and 20 from Florida and 20 from Connecticut, it will maintain those proportions. And if your original data had like the correlations, like New Yorkers spend a lot more on Friday night compared to Connecticut and Florida, it will have those statistical properties as well. So it's a very sort of an end-to-end pipeline of how you generate data, where you still preserve the correlations, context, and proportions. Whereas in a fake data set, you just generate anything and randomly.
So as far as I understand then, you're also saying that the test data has an element of realism to it. So does that mean that you've actually trained it on anonymized real data? Is that something I'm hearing? Or
yes. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So there's a subset of anonymized real data on which you can train.
Okay.
And the software, like most of the users install the software right next to where the data is in the environment there, and then they can actually train a model. Yes.
Okay, cool. And what are some of the most of the use cases that customers are using it for at the moment? Is it mostly sort of,
performance testing,
marketing, sales, that kind of thing, or is it data testing, or a bit of everything?
So we have within application testing, it's performance testing, as well as data portability. So one of the powerful things is that if you don't want to move the data, you can build a model right next to the data and move the model. So model usually turns out to be, even if your database is terabytes in size, model is like a single file, a couple of gigabytes. So now you can move the model in different environments because it's much more easily portable and sample from it. And you don't have any sort of any connection to the real data other than it has the statistical properties of it at aggregate level. So data portability is another big use case. Okay. The other two interesting other use cases people are using it for is trying to enhance the predictive models that they built by augmenting synthetic data to real data. Mm-hmm. So this is a situation where, for example, if you take the bank transactional fraud prediction, you usually have less than 1% of fraud. You have 99% no fraud cases and 1% of fraud. And if you try to build a predictive model using, predictive AI, it will try to overfit the data for the fraud that it has seen. And as a result, it's not that robust. In other words, it won't get as accurate as it should be to be able to deploy it. So in that case, what users are doing is they're building a model, and then they're creating samples that are in the neighborhood of the fraud, and they're creating more data around the neighborhood of fraud to give that the predictive AI model a way to not overfit. So that's the second use case. It's a very classic use case for synthetic data. So that's one of the use cases that people are doing. The third use case that we are seeing a lot come up is simulation or scenario generation.
Yeah.
So this is where you go to the generative model and say, if my, let's imagine this is an insurance data set. And if you say, if I have 10% more smokers enroll in my policies, what would be its impact on the claims distribution?
Okay.
So you can start looking, you know, doing some analysis, and that's what the generative model also allows, or synthetic data also allows you to do.
Yeah. And I can also see you got this, another interesting one is this sequential. So not just a data source, but this thing happened, then this thing happened, then this thing happened. And of course, branching from that and all that kind of thing. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Sequential pathways, identifying sequential pathways. What if these five things happen in sequence? What will be the next?
That's interesting. Okay. So what are the major differences between the open source libraries you have and then the enterprise on top? What are you offering in addition to the open source libraries?
Yeah, for open source library, I mean, we changed the license. We call it source available. But, you know, in enterprise, we have very important properties that are required for enterprises, which is being able to scale to many, many different tables, build a model for more than 20 tables or more than, and in open source, you can do at most 3 to 5. In enterprise, we built algorithms, generative modeling algorithms that actually enable you to build models for, you know, up to 100 tables. Now, some enterprises have only tested up to 50. We haven't fully tested up to 100, but the algorithm itself can model up to 100 tables.
Okay.
And then in enterprise, we allow this contextual anonymization. So different data types, phone numbers, addresses, emails, what have you. And ultimately, all the way, like, you know, one of the car company wanted to have VIN numbers, vehicle identification numbers generated. So we provide a lot of generators that are based on the contextual anonymization that we were talking about. The third important thing that enterprises need that we also enable in enterprise version is that they would like to be able to encode some business rules.
Or at least specify them at
a very high level. So not have to worry, like write too much code, but with a very low code interface. So these are the kind of rules where, you know, in insurance data set, for example, you have a date of birth column and, you know, date of policy activation column. I mean, by definition, date of policy activation has to be greater than date of birth.
Yeah.
So they should be able to specify that as a rule so that the generative model can make sure that it generates and validates itself when the samples are generated from it.
Yeah. Now, we can't really have any kind of conversation on generative AI without talking a little bit about some of the problems. Now, I think it's interesting in your case because what you're replacing was not necessarily any better. Mock data in testing was generally pretty poor and full of made up things anyway. But what checks have you put in place to ensure that the synthetic data doesn't get corrupted with things that are just nonsense and will ruin some of the
hallucinations?
I can see you have this SD metrics. I'm not sure if that's part of it, but
we launched very early on. We realized that, you know, the evaluation is going to be a big need, because, you know, you create synthetic data, like, how do we evaluate whether it's close enough to real data or it has the properties or it's just hallucinating? So we launched this library, SD Metrics. It is open source.
Yep.
And we built a lot of metrics in it and implemented a lot of them to assess the quality. So we divide the metrics into three groups. One is quality. So quality just gives you how statistically similar it is to the real data, how many properties of the real data, statistically speaking, are captured in synthetic data. And then there is a measure called diagnostics. And diagnostics are must-haves.
Okay.
So data should have referential integrity, formatting of phone numbers. You know, if it's in a certain way in the real data, that's how it should be in the synthetic data, because downstream applications depend on that.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of diagnostic metrics that we have, and we generate that. That report has to be 100% accurate. The third is privacy metrics. So we implemented a well-known privacy metrics in that library. And that is privacy, as you can imagine, is always in contention with the first one. So the more closer you get to real data, the more likely you're going to though it's not the real data or a copy of it, but still more likely you may leak some privacy related information. So we have some privacy metrics. These are like, I don't know, people may know, heard about it, called differential privacy. These are very, very stringent metrics. So that's the way our sort of users compare. And it has become like, it has taken a life of its own. A lot of people now use that for comparing with any synthetic data coming from any source, not just our library, but from any source.
It's kind of interesting because you've almost created like a, I don't know how familiar you are with, there's another world I work in a lot, this kind of like, no, completely side to this, like the sort of Kubernetes DevOps kind of world. And there's a lot of these things now around like policy agents to ensure that people only can access, install certain versions of certain applications in certain places and all this kind of thing. And there's a lot of conversation now about how you automate that, the enforcing of that policy. And in some respects here, you've almost created like a policy for generating fake data, which is kind of interesting way of gatekeeping the problems. I could imagine it would definitely have a lot of use cases in a much broader way, you know, even if it came to something like image generation. Well, it's harder to check because you'd have to analyze the image and that kind of thing. But
Oh, that's interesting you say that. We've been thinking about that because in the image generation, it has to be visually assessed.
Yeah, which is more complicated, but not impossible.
It goes cuts both ways. It's interesting because in this case, you can programmatically assess.
Yeah.
But on the other side, like when somebody tries to visually assess, they are like, I don't see the difference. I can't tell you. But in image, you can right away say, it's a interesting comparing images, and this is a very interesting
So the company is a couple of years old, but it was a couple of months ago announced seed funding, which is actually quite high for a seed funding round. So what do you think investors saw in the products that encouraged them to invest quite so much in a seed round?
I think we have, because we went through a community version, which is still source available, and people use that a lot, like all the enterprises use that to do POC and define ROI, or at least establish ROI for our product. That was very promising because I think I would say at least 50 out of Fortune 500 have already, SDV is already in their distribution.
Okay.
And they have used it and they have tried to figure out an ROI for it. And so when they come to us for SDV Enterprise, they've already established how this product can help them achieve business value. A lot of challenges with AI products is that ROI is never clear. I think that's one of the biggest challenges for AI products.
Yeah,
or it is something that you will know like a year later, or invest in it for 3-4 years, then you will get to know it. So our product was not like that.
No.
I think we were getting a lot more traction when people did POCs and they have a clear understanding. So that was one of the big things in that played a role. And then the second is obviously, as I said, 50 out of Fortune 500 are already installed and have been using it and have demonstrated use cases throughout the spectrum. And finally, I think we were very deliberate of how we are going to develop the source available version, enterprise version. We listen to enterprises very closely. Enterprise data is a complex beast.
Yeah.
If there's anything, I've been in predictive AI before this for 10 years. If there's anything I've learned in predictive AI and those platforms is that they ignored the complexity of enterprise data and ignored the complexity of enterprise processes and people involved in making AI, realizing AI. So that is something that when we started the company, we brought that experience over and we made sure that on day one, we focus on enterprise data sets and their complexity. The scientific data sets and the benchmarking data sets that are available publicly, they don't represent, I'm sorry to say, they don't represent less than 1% of the complexity of the enterprise data.
Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of cool demonstration tools at the moment, but you wonder how useful they really are. And the ones that I've personally found useful are the ones that really connect, and this is nothing new, of course, really connecting to solving a problem in a way that wasn't solvable before, or improving the way it was. Like, people always needed test data. And generally before this point, it was just kind of nonsense you made up and that was it. Whereas, you know, new ways to generate images and things, is it's kind of cool, but
And also, like, test data generation was like a boring task. Like, one of the developers that said, oh, this is a boring task.
Yes.
And this makes it cool for them. Like, so this is like, oh, now we can put a generative model in our pipeline.
Exactly.
We can train it from time to time. So it makes test data cool again.
And even better than that, you're not really replacing anyone's job, because no one was ever really doing this in the first place. Cool. Okay. So things are relatively new, but what's on the roadmap for this year? What are some of the new features you're working on that you're excited to maybe announce?
Yeah, we are working on a lot of, you know, sort of day zero ability to build generative model on day zero without a lot of preparation. As you can imagine, that enterprises also depend on a lot of external third-party applications. So we are trying to help to see if we can pre-package. So if you have a ServiceNow application, you can build a generative model from a ServiceNow database. If you have another application, you can do that as well. So we are focused on doing that. We are also trying to launch the second use case, which is data augmentation for machine learning model development.
Okay, so that's the
second one also we are doing.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That was that was a very to the point answer. Okay. So, I mean, if people are interested in what you've been up to, then really, there is no free version of the enterprise. You use the community version, which will take you to a certain point. And then I guess you know if it's something that interests you. And from is the experience with the enterprise version similar to the community version? It's an SDK that people incorporate, or when it comes to the enterprise version, is there a little bit more kind of, I don't know, user-friendly onboarding, et cetera, or is it a similar process?
There is user-friendly onboarding more in enterprise version, but we don't change the calls remains the same, so that they don't, if they have access to more models, they don't have to change anything around it. They just have to swap the model, the name that they use. So we keep everything pretty similar, but the user-friendliness is more incorporated in enterprise version.
Makes sense. Okay, super interesting. I could think of some things I could mess around with to give it a try, but it would be with the community version. So it's the same. But I do have some thoughts. Yeah, it ties into some other ideas. But cool. Awesome. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks. Nice chatting with you. Thank you.
And that was my interview with Data Sibo. I think that's how you pronounce it. I don't know if I ever asked that. Anyway, how else would you? I'm not sure. I won't give you too many updates this time because, frankly, I am just too out of sync with the world right now. I remember this from last time we were in Australia. I sort of thought it's just so hard to be connected to the world you're used to. You almost just give up at a certain point. So, yeah, I have been doing some things, but I've been mostly just trying to keep on top of things, really. So I will save updates from me probably maybe next week, although that'll be like a day after we get back. So who knows what state I'm going to be in. So in the coming weeks, I think I will say, because there are a few things to update you on. But for now, I have been Christian Chiller. Thank you very much for joining me. And as always, take care, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the show. Find out more about me at christianchiller.com. where you can find show notes, sign up for my newsletter, and find all of my writing, games, work, and video links. There's also details on how to get in touch with me. And if you want to get even closer to what I do, join my Discord server for behind-the-scenes discussions, helping me produce my shows and work.